welcome to class today. Glad to see you all here. I realized that 2 weeks ago, somebody asked me what something looked like, and I said, I'll tell you on Tuesday, and now it's 2 weeks later and I haven't yet. So, we're actually going to start by talking about lenticular images, and then we'll come back and talk about anything else you want to talk about. So let's talk about lenticular images. Or more accurately called lenticular printing, although that's a weird phrase too because it doesn't have a lot to do with printing. All right, the basic idea of lenticular images, this is a highly zoomed in, let's suppose that, let's make this highly zoomed in. This is paper seen from the side, right? Which means we have ink here on top, okay? And the purpose of lenticular images is to give you the illusion of stereoscopic vision so that your left eye and your right eye see different things. The way this works is we put on top of this sort of lumpy plastic. Okay? The shape of the lumps and the size of the lumps and distribution of the lumps and how far away they are from the paper all matter. And so we have this lumpy plastic set layer over top of what is printed. We can do it with things other than plastic and with things other than printed, but this is the basic idea. Why would we do this? Well, the first thing to remember about curved surfaces is when light hits heavier things than air, it slows down, which makes it sort of bend towards the normal. So if I think about light that's various rays that would be sort of all coming in parallel off of this bump, these ones will tend to bend in, and so they'll tend to all focus like a lens. Okay? So then to focus those rays of light in on some particular area. But what particular area will depend on the angle at which these rays were drawn. So if I were to draw them like this, they will also bend in, but they'll bend in on a different spot. Okay? And so the basic principle of lenticular images is we make sure that the curvature and spacing and depth of these is such that if you're a reasonable distance away and your eyes are an average distance apart, for most humans that's about 2.5 inches, although it varies a lot by individual, but not enough that lenticular images usually matter. We want to make sure that your left eye and your right eye are looking at different things. So what we actually print is we make a picture that you would see from your left eye. Let's suppose we were looking at somebody from very close up. So from your left eye, you sort of see the left side of the right side of their face. And from your right eye, you sort of see the left side of their face. Okay? If they're very, very close to you, this would be sort of the idea. We chop them into tiny little strips. Okay? So we make tiny little strips of these images, and we interleave them. So we put sort of a right eye part and a left eye part, and a right eye part and a left eye part, and a right eye part and a left eye part, and then deal with the fact your eyes are sufficiently far apart that you'll focus in. And so when you look at it for the entirety of this section, it'll all be focused into your right eye will see a right eye part, your left eye will see a left eye part. And then for the entirety of this section, you'll see another one of these. And so across the entire image, your right eye will only see right eye parts, your left eye will only see left eye parts. You will get the impression that you are looking at a stereoscopic image. Early ones of these were pretty large, and if you look at them, it looks like you can see like visible banding. They have this weird sort of banded effect. Over time, we've gotten better at making these, so they've been able to get smaller. And then we also have like adaptive displays that will use eye tracking software as your head moves to switch which one's left and right so that you'll still get a 3D idea and so on. Anyway, but this is the basic idea of how I get some stereoscopic image without having to worry about using special glasses or something to block half of the image. We put it directly next to the image itself. Question about lenticular images. In case it wasn't clear, this is not something you can readily do by just like tweaking your computer, right? I suppose you could try to buy a cover that is a lenticular cover you could put on your computer. You have to make sure it's exactly the right distance from however large your pixels are. Anyway, it's complicated to make this work. There certainly are. You can buy 3D screens that are designed to do this. But then, as you move side to side, which eye sees which one would flip unless you do something important about that. And so that usually involves some sort of eye tracking or requiring you to sit in a fixed position and so on. So That takes care of my two-week-old cue. That said, thoughts, comments, questions, other things for me before we dive into what we're supposed to talk about today. Yes? Yeah, that's true, because I don't plan to grade them until the next day, so, you know, turn them in. Yeah?
What causes the effect on monitors, on some monitors, where, like, when you look at them, the side is completely black? And then
okay, yeah. The field of view of monitors. Yes, we will talk about that. What else? Yeah?
If you press on a screen, it's different, too.
Yeah. So finger color screen, I don't know what you call this, but we'll just make something up. There are much cooler things you could do back in the days of CRTs by holding an electromagnet near a computer monitor. Whoa, could you do trippy things? Anyway. Yeah, you could easily destroy the monitor. CRTs are fairly fragile because, you know, they're basically large engines trying to shoot electrons at high speeds into something. There's lots of ways that can go wrong, as it turns out. Okay, anything else? Oh, I should comment, the quiz had a miskey on it. I think I fixed that just now, but anyway, hopefully that didn't spook any of you. All right, yeah, so let's talk about these effects. And both of these are most commonly seen. There are, I should say, these can happen in multiple ways depending on the monitor technology, but you've probably seen these the most with liquid crystal displays. So let's talk briefly about how liquid crystal displays work. So the key of a liquid crystal display is a liquid crystal. What is a liquid crystal? Right? A crystal means all of the molecules are held in a rigid structure, and a liquid means they're all bumbling around at random. So what is a liquid crystal? Oh, weird words, right? We're not going to go into the material science of liquid crystals. The reason we care about liquid crystals in computing, and in monitors in particular, is because they have this thing we call, that's not the phrase of it. They rotate polarization. Okay? When any light passes through a liquid crystal, the polarization spins. And the amount it spins depends on various properties of liquid crystal, including how the differential across them. So by applying voltage or magnetic fields or heat or lots of things to them, you can change how quickly the polarization spins as it passes through. So the basic idea of a liquid crystal display, as you probably have on most of your devices, okay, is we actually sort of have three layers. We're going to have glowy stuff back here, a light of some kind. Making a light that makes a good display is a non-trivial task, which we aren't going to go into at all. There's a surprising amount of engineering to make something that sort of all glows uniformly, okay? Then we have color filters. Okay, this can actually go on the other side if it wants. Okay, and there's pros and cons to putting it in the front and the back that aren't hugely important. So I have color filters, and this will be in big blocks at the scale I'm drawing, right? So I have a big block of green, and then we'll have a big block of blue, and a big block of red, and so on. So the glow that makes it through that filter is of one color. And then we are going to have cells, transparent cells of liquid crystal. Okay? So this is going to be a liquid crystal. And there is going to be some way of applying a varying, usually electrical, sometimes magnetic field across liquid crystal. And that will change the rate of polarization. That's important because we're going to have, we'll draw it here, although it's often on the other side. We're going to have a polarizing lens here, and we're going to have another polarizing lens here. So this is the big setup. So, glow, polarize. So now all the light has one of its wavelengths is all aligned. Color, go through a liquid crystal, that wavelength twists as it goes through the liquid crystal. Bumps into the other polarizing filter. If it is twisted so that it's now lined up with the other polarizing filter, it all just shines through nicely and we see it. If it's twisted so it's anti-aligned, right angles to that, it doesn't pass through and it becomes black. Okay? And as we twist that around, We can change the charge, change how much light we are seeing. So for each individual color component of each pixel, we apply an individual potential difference across the crystal to change its amount of twist. This is how they normally work. How does this cause field of view problems? Well, it's caused because the amount of rotated polarization is based on how much liquid crystal you pass through. And so if we consider this ray of light and this ray of light, they pass through a different amount of liquid crystal. So they get a different amount of polarization twist. But the polarizing filters on each side aren't changing to match, and so you will see a different amount of polarization. Actually, a liquid crystal display, there is some level at which you'll see it invert. The black will become light, and the light will become black, right? Because it will have passed through so much liquid crystal that if it was trying to twist it enough to be visible, it will be invisible, and vice versa. This is also because this is literally a liquid, and because the way we try to get rid of that is by making the liquid crystal relatively narrow. There's small little things are harder to mess, have less chance of that happening. When you put your gargantuan, in this picture, finger on the screen and push, you squish the liquid crystal, okay? And so it all gets all twisted around. Yeah. Thoughts, comments, questions? Yeah?
So the same thing wouldn't happen to, say, like an OLED screen, like when you press on the screen.
So, right. So an OLED, otherwise known as an organic liquid light-emitting diode, right? This is, in principle, just a way of creating the glow. Okay, so does an OLED have to be different? Well, it depends on if that's all it's doing or if it's doing more. The nice thing about light-emitting diodes is they're very responsive to change in voltage. So you can blink an LED much, much faster than you can change the electrical charge across this. So there's often they use these to change the intensity, but they don't always. Sometimes you'll see something advertised as an OLED display, but it will actually still use liquid crystals to modulate things because it's cheaper. Some of them will actually use OLEDs directly to modulate the light and they'll have and the color filter, in which case there won't be any liquid crystal, in which case you will not see this kind of effect. But note organic. What does organic mean?
Plants.
Yeah, no pesticides. No. containing carbon, okay? But usually meaning created by biologists. Okay, OLEDs is, and there's a whole lot of these, they vary a lot. Many of them are designed to be flexible or slightly gooey, and so some of them are still sensitive to pressure of different kinds, although typically not nearly as much as a liquid crystal display. Other thoughts, comments, questions? All right. So, today, our topic du jour is homogeneous coordinates, or if you prefer, homogeneous coordinates. Although we typically say homogeneous coordinates in the graphic circles I have interacted with, I don't actually know why. So we have these are a way of representing vectors that makes life simpler, but it's a little complicated to explain. So I'm going to try several different ways, in hopes that either the intersection of them all or one of them will make sense to each of you, and then we will probably at some point just declare that you understand them and move on, even if you don't. Because to use them day to day, you don't really truly have to grok how they work. But it's useful to grok how they work because it gives you some better intuition. So, let's start by just reviewing basic vectors. Vectors, as we all know, have an orientation and a magnitude, but not an origin. Or they are a triple of numbers or a double of numbers, depending on what space they are in. But notice when I draw it like this, I'm implicitly having two points I'm specifying. A pure vector, one of those points is always 0, 0, 0. It goes from 0, 0, 0 to somewhere else. And so we would represent, let's just arbitrarily pick, let's say that was 8 and that was 7, I would represent that as 8, 7. Hey, a vector can be multiplied by a matrix, which is a linear transformation. Okay? Linear transformations, as we should have all learned back in linear algebra, or even when you learn vectors theoretically in algebra, depending on who had teaching it, linear transformations are combinations of rotation and scaling. Okay? They can squish and stretch, and they can twist around the origin, but nothing else. So if you multiply a vector by a matrix, it does this. Okay? We like to use matrices because they're just multiplication and addition, and computers are good at those. They aren't so good at trig functions. So we typically don't do trig if we can get around it. Question?
Are we like including reflection as part of
the... Yeah, sorry, I guess we also have reflection. Reflection, of course, is just the same thing as a negative coordinate scale. Okay, to reflect across something is to scale in a negative along that axis. Okay. So we can turn it all into rotations and scalings. And in linear algebra, there's this really cool thing called the singular value decomposition that turns all matrices into these. And in my experience, is almost never emphasized as much as it truly deserves. The singular value decomposition is one of the most important things in linear algebra that always gets pushed down to the side. Anyway, complete aside. For some reason, they don't have me teach that course. They're probably right. All right. So if I think about this, I can, if I had some object that I had defined as a whole, let's say I have some lumpy object, I could define it as a set of vectors. Okay? A vector for every point along the surface of the object. And using a matrix, I could spin it around, I could stretch it out, but I can't move it. Okay? This point right here will never change. If you multiply the vector 0, 0 by through any matrix, it stays 0, 0. That point is fixed. And moving things turns out to be useful. So matrices are a beautiful way of moving things around, except they don't work. And so homogeneous coordinates are a way of trying to fix this. And we try to fix this by imagining there was another dimension. Okay, now, it's hard enough to draw three dimensions. We actually use four dimensions in homogeneous coordinates most of the time. I'm going to pretend we're going to use one dimension, real numbers, to talk about this as an initial space. So, let's suppose I have a one-dimensional vector. What is a one-dimensional vector? Well, a one-dimensional space is a number line, and so one-dimensional vector is just a number. Okay? Not a lot I can do with these numbers. If I multiply something by it that's defined in this term by a matrix, right, there's not even any rotating to do, but I can squash it. Okay? That's all I can do with a matrix. However, if I imagine there is this magical extra dimension, this is the real dimension, and this is the fake one, okay? I'm going to pretend there's another dimension. Well, this actually doesn't help me. Right? If I take that initial shape and I multiply it by matrix, sure, I can rotate it around here, but then when I consider only the real part, I just scaled it. That doesn't help. But I can play a weird trick. I can say, you know what, I want always to have the fake dimension be 1. So I'm going to say, the object was really over there. Okay? And then when I rotate it around the origin, it moves. So I can rotate it around the origin and stretch it out and then project it back onto that line and poof, it has smoothed. I have been able to get translation, movement, out of just linear operations by imagining another dimension and then forcing things to lie where that dimension is 1. Okay? Forcing them to lie where that dimension is 1 does involve division, which is more painful than multiplication, but so much nicer than cosines. Okay? So we still have a net computational win. It's a faster way of dealing with all of the different twisting around and scalings and things we might want to do than trying to use trig for the rotations and adding for the translations. This is better. And so that means to move my one-dimensional object, I have a two-dimensional coordinates where one of the dimensions is forced to be 1. I multiply it by some matrix, and then that other dimension isn't 1, and then I fix it by dividing. And that gives me this magical ability to turn linear operators into something that can move things. Now, it can't do arbitrary things. The set of things I can do with this fake dimension is called affine, or affine, or affine, depending on who you ask. So affine transformations clearly include all linear plus all translations, where we move things, and then all things you can do by mixing these two things up. That last piece is a bit complicated, and we'll talk about some specific examples of unexpected things like shear that come out of that. But this is the basic concept of an affine transformation. Perspective transformations also work here. We'll get to some of that later. So this is one way of thinking about homogeneous coordinates. Imagine a fake dimension and force it to be one. Great. Now we're going to talk about a completely different way of imagining homogeneous coordinates. We're going to say, hey, there's this completely abstract notion of a vector. A vector is just an ordered list of elements of a field. Hey, and field is like something that could be a number, but slightly more general, in case you don't remember what fields are. Okay? And so I have an ordered list of elements of a field, and it turns out that I can define a special kind of field that's a little different than the fields you're used to. I'm going to just arbitrarily say that for any particular vector you may want to write, I'm just going to define it to be the same thing if you multiply it by a non-zero constant a for all a that are not equal to zero. I'm just making this as a definition. Okay? And if I just throw this into my definition of vector, what happens? This is sort of the abstract algebra approach to homogeneous coordinates. I add a definition to my axioms and I see what theorems I can still prove. Question?
Well, I was going to answer. It's a rhetorical question.
Oh, yes, sorry. I do plan to go into it a little bit, but yes. Most things still work. But there's weird side effects, okay? First is, this confuses humans. You can train people to think about this, but you probably learned vectors where this vector was not equal to this vector. But in homogeneous coordinates, guess what? They are equal. Hooray! Because you can get between one and the other by multiplying by a constant. And this, we've defined this fact. Now, we've reduced one degree of freedom in what they mean, okay? So this has four, and this, but there's a degree of freedom that's removed by having this, it doesn't matter how you scale it, okay? And so this is only a three-dimensional space in dimensional analysis. And this three-dimensional space, however, has extra fancy behaviors. So in this extra-dimensional space, when I think about a matrix times a vector and getting myself out another vector, if these are this extra I can scale anything by anything matrices and vectors, then this allows me to do, again, affine transformations. As a matter of fact, this is exactly the same. This is equivalent to the fake dimension. Okay? To show that it's equivalent, we typically normalize these things. We call these a homogeneous coordinate. Why homogeneous? Because it is uniform across all scalings. Homogeneous, it's the same everywhere, it's the same across all scalings. I don't know, it seems a little bit of a stretch to me, but this is the thought. Okay? It's homogeneous because it's the same as you scale it. And so we want to say, but how do I know if two are the same? Well, we're just going to normalize it in some fashion. We can normalize it by picking any arbitrary coordinate and multiplying one vector by the inverse of the other one so that those end up being the same. Okay? And traditionally in graphics, we just always pick the last one, which we always label W. Okay, so we're just going to divide everything. So this, in particular, this is always going to be the same as x over w, y over w, z over w over w. But w over w is just 1. Now, this only works if w wasn't 0 to start with. So we're going to force that to be the case in our math. We're never going to let W go to zero. But as long as W isn't zero, we can always do this normalization. We do it to any two vectors that are the same point, and they will resolve into the same point. Okay? And that gives us this fake dimension who is 1, just like we had here. We had the fake dimension that we're forcing to be 1. Okay? So these are equivalent ways of thinking about homogeneous coordinates. And equivalently, they allow us to do affine transformations. Because a rotation followed by a division allows us to do weird things that we wouldn't get if we just rotated without dividing. So this is another equivalent way of defining homogeneous coordinates. Okay. Now we're going to get to the math. Let's just treat it all as a magic black box. Okay? So, in the treating it all as a magic black box, I want to have some point, x, y, z, to represent a point in space. And we're just going to arbitrarily say, oh, 1. Now, as it turns out, sometimes we'll put a 0 there. 1 means this is a point in space. 0 means it's a vector. And we'll talk more about the zero case in a moment, but I want to preview that we're going to say that, and we'll come back to the other two and how that works, okay? So we have some point, and we're going to multiply it by some matrix, okay? And this is going to give us our affine transformations. This matrix, we can conceptually block into different parts. Here we have a 3x3. We have a 3x1, and then we have just the number 1 and 0, 0, 0. Sorry, it's been a while since I had to put numbers here. Is this 3x1 or 1x3? 1x3? Great. Rows by columns? Okay, great. I always forget whether we do rows by columns or columns by rows. And anyway, in computing, we do both. Some programming languages are row major, some are column major by default. Anyway, complete aside. All right, these pieces mean things. This is going to be a linear transformation, which means it is rotation and scale. This is going to be a translation. And this gives us rotation, scale, and translation, and we can actually look at the matrix and split it up. Okay? And if we do this very conveniently, we always end up with the answer is always going to have a 1 down here. Because I multiply this vector by the bottom row and I get a 1. Ta-da! And so I never have to worry about the 1 at all. Because the 1 always exists. I could even say, you know what, I didn't really care about that. And so I can save space by not storing it. I can pretend I had a 1, but not actually have the 1. And then I can pretend like I can multiply a 3 vector by a 3x4 matrix and get a 3 vector out by imagining there was this magic extra row I didn't tell you about. Okay? And this is actually commonly done. If you look at most graphics libraries APIs, they will have something that will say, multiply your vector by a 3x4 matrix. And you're like, what? It means this. Okay? It means pretend there's a 1, do this extra math. Yes?
So would it then just like actually do the 3x3 times the x, y, z, and then just add on?
Yep, just do the x, and then you just add those in. Yep. And which actually saves us a few multiplies, makes things marginally faster. Less space, a little faster to work with. We'll actually see why we want that bottom row here in a moment, because there are magic things we can do if that isn't 0, 0, 0, 1. Okay. So if we think about it in this space, everything's fine. Now there is this question that is not necessarily obvious to most people. Do we translate or rotate first? So, let me see if I can explain more detail what I mean by that question. Let's consider, just for a, we can go back down to two dimensions, okay? Let's consider a matrix that looks like this. Okay? If I do the math, I will see this is going to give me a new vector. It's going to give me the first element's going to be y, the second one's going to be negative x, and then I'm going to have a 1. What did this matrix do besides swapping x and y and making one of them negative? What does it look like it did? Okay. So, let's try doing it with a little triangle. I'm going to draw a triangle here. And I'm just going to try to figure out where did that triangle go. So I'm going to take each point one at a time and figure out what happened to it. So, this point here, x was the same as y, they are both positive. Which means that I'm now going to have x the same as y. Oh, wrong way. But y is negative. Okay? So that point goes there. This point had a bigger x than y, so now I'm going to have a more negative y than x. So it's going to go down there. And this point had a much bigger y than x, so it is going to go over here. Make sure I get this right. Yes. So what was the y-coordinate is going to become the x-coordinate, and what was the x-coordinate is going to become the negative y-coordinate, so it's going to be over there. And so what did I do with this object? I rotated it around the origin 90 degrees clockwise. Questions about this example? Yes?
You say that by doing this that we're avoiding the use of sines and cosines, but this transformation matrix comes from a linear algebra definition with sines and cosines.
Yes, it does. So how did I get these things? I took sines and cosines in my head. But
for an arbitrary angle, you'd have to use.
Yes, absolutely. How many times do I have to compute a sine and a cosine for one transformation?
Once.
Yeah, I mean, arguably one of each, but I can actually get one from the other, sort of. So I have to build this matrix once. How many times did I use it on these points?
One.
3 times. There were 3 points. That's already saving me work from computing the sines and cosines for each of those individually. And if I had more than a triangle, I would be saving more work. So yes, we do the trig once because it's expensive. And then we just make it work thereafter. And actually, it turns out often we can do the trig at compile time and not do it at all in runtime for many realistic scenarios. All right. So I have this rotation matrix. Okay. If I were to change this matrix and add in here S and let's actually make real numbers. No, let's use S and T. If I add S and T, how does that change my result? Well, instead of being Y, this is now Y plus S. This is now X plus T. Okay? And so if S happened to be 0 and T happened to be 10, then that would just move everything this way. And so the translation happens after the rotation. And this matters, because if I had started over here and then rotated, I would have ended up down here. Order of transformations matters. Okay? So coming back here, we do this thing first and this thing second. It's the order they operate on the vector being given. So we can create these transformations, and we can use them to move things, to rotate things, to scale things, to squish and stretch them around, and get various affine transformations. We'll come back to that bottom row in a moment. Questions about this basic concept? Yes?
Is there an intuitive way to visualize like the 3x3 like rotation scale of like what it actually does like visually?
In a 3x3 one, that's really hard. Okay, 2x2 one sort of, but 3x3 one, I don't know of a beautiful way of visualizing that. You see a bunch of numbers there and you're like, what do they mean? Simple ones though, there are some simple ones. We'll actually talk about the component matrices we usually build these things out of. They're going to be very special cases. And then we'll talk about why they're special cases and how we make other things out of them. Before we dive into that, other questions about this concept, this goal? Yes?
So does storing a larger matrix like this save computing time over like just storing two separate matrices, one for the translation and one for the iteration?
I mean, no, that's probably because you have spatial locality, but nothing significant. But this will allow us to do weirder things beyond that. In particular, allow us to compose transformations. Okay? So as we think about, and that's actually a really, that was where I was going to go in a moment, but we'll do it now, right? If I take some vector and I multiply it by two matrices, okay? So I have some vector and I multiply it by two matrices to get my new vector. These happen in order. Whatever this says to do happens first, and then whatever this says to do happens. And it happens to the moved points from this. We work our way through right to left. Okay? In particular, if that first one was to move it over to the right, and then the second one was to rotate, we end up below where we started. Right? These are not commutative. I can't move them between each other. But I can multiply these things together to come up with a combined matrix. So if I'm going to do a lot of operations, instead of multiplying the vector by each matrix one at a time for all of the points in the scene, I combine all the matrices into one, and then I just multiply the point by it. And so this is why matrices, lots of efficiencies we get out of matrices. I can do the operations without worrying about trig. I can combine them all into one thing before I start doing it all of the points and make everything run significantly faster. In particular, this means transforming points costs something in proportional to the number of points, but not proportional to the complexity of the transformation. Because all transformations are equally complex when we're done. They're all just a matrix. And that is convenient when you have complicated moving scenes. You do the complicated movement once, you move all of the points once, and you don't have to have this multiplicative factor in your resulting complexity. Yes?
And are these going to end up being matrices and vectors or floats?
Oh yeah, almost always. Yeah, we almost never use integers for these things. In particular, it's really hard to make meaningful transformations with integers. Other questions? All right. Let's talk about the most important matrices to understand. Okay? So, the key matrix pieces. First, let's talk about this matrix. Okay, this matrix is rotation. Assuming here that c squared plus s squared equals 1. Now, c squared plus s squared equals 1 is a famous identity. What is it true of? Cosines and sines. Okay, so if I think about c as the cosine of some theta, and s is the sine of that theta, then this matrix here rotates by theta in the xz plane. I know it's the xz plane because x and z are the axes that have non-identity components, that have the s and the c and the s in them. We often think about that as about being around the y-axis. It's equivalent to saying in the xz plane. Okay? And so if I were to think about, try to draw, of course I'm drawing so it never really looked 3D, but if I draw the traditional 3D axes, x, y, z, I believe that's a right-handed coordinate system. Yes, okay, good. So I draw a 3D axis. This thing here rotates in this plane. No, wrong plane. Ah! It doesn't rotate in that plane. I just said it rotates in the XZ plane, right? So it rotates in this plane, or around this axis. Okay. And I can make these for any of the three axes by moving which places have the cosines and the sines. Notably, cosines go on the principal axis, the sines go off of it, and the sines have different signs. And this is just how it works. You do it backwards, it doesn't work. Okay? If you don't have different signs, it doesn't work. It does something else. If you want to do a rotation, this is what it looks like. So I can rotate around any principal axis. If I can rotate around any principal axis, I can combine rotations around principal axis to do any rotation I want. Okay? And we'll talk a little about how we might build such a transformation here in a moment. So that's one of the key pieces. The second key piece is a translation matrix. Get enough zeros here. Okay. So this is a translate. This moves x on the x-axis and y on the y-axis and z on the z-axis. It just moves things. Okay? This one doesn't require any trig because translation doesn't require any trig. It just moves things. Huzzah. Okay? That makes our life easy. Okay? And the last one we usually talk about, although technically there's one more that we want to think about. Well, we'll just talk about one more for now. The last one we usually think about is a diagonal matrix with non-1 entries on the main diagonal. This is a scale. It stretches by a factor of Sx in the x-axis, Sy in the y-axis, Sz in the z-axis. If these are bigger than 1, it gets bigger. If it's smaller than 1, it gets smaller. Okay? And so I can scale. And these are the core kinds of affine transformation pieces. There is a combination of these three in the right order with the right axes that will do whatever it is you want to do that's affine. We sometimes will talk about other things like shearing and so on as well. Shearing is technically a rotation, a scaling, and another rotation. It happens to look tidy when we look at it. And so this not really as important one, let's use green for the not really as important one, okay, has ones along the principal diagonal, has zeros in the translation places, and then has other numbers off of the main diagonal. Okay, and so I can think about this value here. I don't know, let's just arbitrarily pick this. Okay. These values here, I guess I can do all of them. Okay, these values here tell me how much to scale one axis based on the length, the size, and the other axis. They end up causing these things we think of as shearing if you set just one of them. I find these things to be more confusing to think about than useful. I did link to a thing that talks about shearing. One of the links on the write-up talks about shearing. You're welcome to read through it. They even have a place where you can drag on a graph and see things shear and see the matrix if you want to practice learning shearing. But it's relatively uncommon to want to think about shearing in graphics in my experience, so I don't think it's worth spending a huge amount of time on. Here, yeah. Yeah, so if you think about it as a plane, you put the C's in those two axes. And then the one that has the one is the axis you're rotating around. I actually prefer thinking about it in a plane because I spent way too much of my life thinking about higher dimensional spaces. That was my master's thesis, was how do you do various things in 5 and 6 dimensional space. And planes works in all dimensions, axes doesn't. But that's a complete aside. Many people think about axes instead. Yes?
Is it more common to do to combine a component like rotations, or like try to put them all in like one transformation matrix? Or
yes, it is common. If I want to translate some object, I typically think about each of the individual steps I want to do. I write all of those matrices and I multiply them all together into one mega matrix that I actually use in my computing. So, yes, I think about the components, and I combine them all up. Yes?
If you
want to rotate around an arbitrary axis.
Yeah.
Can you do that easily by composing the 3D small axes?
You can. No, yeah, absolutely. We can rotate around an arbitrary axis by composing smaller rotations. Let's think about how we would do that. Okay. That was actually the next thing I was planning. It is very unusual for comments to come right when I wanted them. All right. So here I have my principal axes. Here is X, here is Y, here is Z. And here is some, I don't know, let's just pick some arbitrary axis that I want to rotate around. Maybe I want to rotate around this axis here. I don't even know what that looks too much like negative Z, X. Let's pick this axis here. I want to rotate around that axis. How do I do that? Okay, so to do this only with component axis translations, the process is as follows. One, I rotate this axis to lie along a principal axis. Two, I rotate around the principal axis. Three, I rotate it back. Okay, so that first step actually involves two parts. So my first thing is I'm going to rotate the axis into, I don't know, let's arbitrarily pick the XY plane. That's going to give me some matrix. I'm going to call that R1. So maybe I'm going to rotate that down, and maybe in the XY plane it shows up over there. I don't know. We'll just pick something more or less arbitrarily that could be where it shows up in the XY plane. How do I do that? I just compare its magnitude in XY to its other magnitude and use arctans. I don't actually need the arctans. I'm immediately going to take the sines and cosines of them, and so anyway, you can save yourself a little bit of work. But you do that first. Okay, a little bit of trig, and you've got that done. Number two, I rotate it onto one of the axes. Let's say onto the positive y axis, just to pick something at random. That'll give me another rotation matrix. So now, I probably should have used a different color here. Now I'm going to rotate that around until it lines up with the y axis. Okay. Then step three is going to be rotate around y by my angle. So I'm going to spin around y, which is now my rotated axis. And then after that, oh, that is, I guess, also going to be a matrix. So let's call that R3. And then I'm going to go backwards. So now step four is going to be undo two. And finally step five is going to be to undo one. I now have five matrices. All of them are principal axis matrices. I found the first two using a little trig or a little bit of hypotenuse formula. But I just found them based on what axis I wanted to be on, okay? And so now I can multiply all of these together. And the order I do that in is I do the first thing I wanted to do on the right. And I multiply those things all together, and poof, here is my matrix that rotates around an arbitrary number of theta around an arbitrary axis. Now, I could actually do this every time, or I could try to push this all through in symbolic algebra and figure out what this matrix looks like. And this particular one turns out to be common enough, somebody has pushed this through and found the formula. And you can look it up, or rederive it yourself, or do it manually with five matrices. Is it more efficient to look it up or derive it yourself? Probably, except, remember, we're doing this once per transformation, not once per point in the scene. Typically, number of transformations is much, much lower than the complexity of the scene, and so it doesn't actually cost us that much to try to do them all. Yes?
Are all these, transformations always going to be invertible?
Rotations are always invertible. Translations are always invertible. Scales are not. If I scale by zero in something, it's not invertible, but otherwise it is. Actually, rotations are perfectly invertible. You can invert them by taking the transpose with no loss of precision. Yes?
Do we need homogeneous coordinates to do this?
Yes. No. I don't have any translations. I only need homogeneous coordinates if I have translations.
Okay.
I don't have any translations. This will work in non-homogeneous coordinates too. But if I wanted to rotate around an arbitrary axis and an arbitrary point, then I would add on either side of this a translation to move that point to the origin before I start moving the axis into the right direction, and then I would need homogeneous coordinates. Yes?
The origin is just like a concept, right? You can just call whatever you want the origin.
Sure. I can pick an arbitrary origin, but I can't arbitrarily change the origin halfway through and expect everything to work. So if I have multiple objects that need to move, they need to move relative to each other. If each of them has their own origin, they're just moving by themselves. So we can pick whatever origin we want, but we have to pick one. Other questions? Okay. So far we've talked about the affine transformation effect of homogeneous coordinates. Okay? They allow us to do more than linear. They allow us to rotate, scale, reflect normally, but also to translate. And we do that, when we're doing that, we have this extra coordinate, but we can divide by it to make it force it to be one, and we're just going to treat this bottom as always the same. What happens if that bottom isn't always the same? And the answer is hyperbolic geometry, but we're not going to deal with how complicated that really is. In practice, the answer is perspective projections. Okay? Perspective projections are a little bit weird to describe, but we're going to give it a go. So, let's start without thinking about matrices at all. We're just going to try to talk about what do we mean by perspective. Okay? When I draw something and I say, ooh, that's in perspective. Let's draw something in perspective, shall we? Okay, let's suppose I have something and I say, I am drawing something in perspective. Okay? And we look at it and we say, oh, that looks sort of like whatever we think it looks like. I don't know, a cheese grater seen from below or whatever it is we think it looks like. Why do we think that? Well, the principle behind perspective actually has to do with how we are looking at the picture. The thing you are looking at is flat, or very nearly so. Okay? And so what I'm trying to do is put on the flat thing something similar to what you would see if you were looking at a 3D thing. And so if I think about that, I am saying, all right, you've got yourselves eyes. I'm going to assume that. And I am showing you something flat. And I want to put on the flat lines that would approximate some actual shape in the real world. Okay? And so how do I do that? Well, I take each of these points in the real world. I say, if they are going to go into the eye, where would they have hit the plane? Okay, and so I do that for every point that I think you can see. And as I go through this exercise, I'm going to find out, oh, this ended up having some sort of different projection. I'm pretty bad at manually drawing projections. But anyway, right? You push them all through and you see where they go. Now, this is actually a lot like something we described earlier about the fake axis idea of homogeneous coordinates. If I were to just say this spot here, let's arbitrarily pick this direction to be z, I could say this is the z equals 1 plane. And if I just arbitrarily decide that's the z equals 1 plane, oh, let's call your I the origin. Why not? If I call your I the origin and the projection plane, the z equals 1 plane, then taking this object and putting it on there was normalizing your homogeneous coordinates. Okay? And so what are we doing when we're projecting? We're dividing by depth. If it's farther away, I divide by a bigger number. That is the geometry of this perspective, okay? Now, we could do this by rotating the scene so that depth was in the W axis. But we don't define geometry with a w-axis. So that isn't what we want to do. Because we don't want a w-axis to exist, because I don't know how to get artists to create 4D models for me. They're going to create, at best, 3D models, and then I'm going to divide by something else. And so the way we make perspective work in a matrix, okay, if I think about my matrix back in parts, okay, so I said here that I have my linear stuff, I have my translation, and then this bottom is going to be my perspective. Because this is going to end up being that W coordinate, and the W coordinate is what I divide by. So I want to make sure this thing I divide by turns out to be depth in the scene. So I want to take whatever points you have, and I want to make sure this thing turns out to be the depth in the scene. Well, depth in the scene is simply distance from the origin. Distance is not a linear function. Okay? It is a square root of a quadratic function, which I can't do with linear things. But I could take the z distance depth, because I'm projecting on a plane, and get a linear depth just fine. So I pick some axis that I think is depth, okay, and I figure out how do I write an equation, a linear equation of x, y, z, and a constant that will tell me how far away something was from the eye in that axis. And I write the coefficients of that linear equation here. So I write a linear equation of depth. For different definitions of what the eye is and how big your plane is and where you want all your points to end up when you're done and so on, there's different ways of writing this linear equation. But it's just, I'm just finding a line, right? And I'm just writing the line equation down here. The XYZ coordinates tend to be some scaled version of the direction you're looking, the direction vector you're inspecting. And the W coordinate, the last, that bottom right corner, actually tells you sort of how far you are from the origin in typical ways. There's other ways of dealing with this, but this is the most common. And then when I multiply some point in the scene, X, Y, Z, 1, by this, I end up with, I find the ordinary sort of transformed X, transformed Y, transformed Z. But then here, I have depth. And when I divide by depth, I end up squashing it onto a plane, or actually a three-dimensional plane here. But we will just ignore one of the depths in the end there. And then we can draw. We'll just sort of ignore this and draw that. Okay, and poof, we now have a way of doing perspective. Question?
So the that bottom row in the matrix, those are going to be the coefficients of the linear equation of depth?
Yep.
Okay. So if that equation doesn't include a z, is that...
Then I'd have a zero there.
Okay.
Yep.
Because you're solving for z there, right?
Well, if my camera is pointing down z, but what if it's pointing down x? Yeah.
Can we change, like, effectively the focal length of our viewpoint by changing the equation to perspective?
There is no focus here.
But I mean, like, in terms of, like...
The field of view?
Yeah.
The field of view is based on what subset of the X's and Y's I look at.
Okay, yeah.
I look at more of the Megidebilger field of view. And actually, this is a really bad field of view, as it turns out. It focuses on the wrong things. We'll talk more about that in a moment.
What would changing the coefficients change then?
So it'll change what I'm dividing by. So if I were to just multiply this whole row by 2, then I'd end up with a double size W, which means I divide by twice as big, which make everything look smaller. But I can then scale back up to make that work. So this matrix is also homogeneous. If I multiply this whole matrix by a constant, it doesn't change the result in a meaningful way, because homogeneous points, homogeneous matrix, homogeneous coordinates, multiplying by a scalar doesn't matter. So you can think of, it's exactly the same thing to double this or to have that. They do exactly the same work. Other questions? Yeah?
Is perspective the only thing that influences the bottom row, or like the squashing?
Now, yes and no. Perspective is what the bottom row does, but it doesn't have to be camera projection perspective. Because I said we throw away z, but why did I pick z? I could have thrown away x, or I could have kept them all and said I now have this different 3D object that is weirdly squished. What we're actually doing is this allows us to move things around in a hyperbolic or elliptical geometry, and then convert that back down into Euclidean geometry and do stuff with it. And yes, there are more things you can do here. If you have taken special relativity, you may be familiar with W coordinates, because they also show up there, and they mean something else there and anywhere. Right? Like, but there's cool things you can do with this that we almost never do in graphics. As a random aside, this does mean that graphics hardware can generally render spherical or hyperbolic geometries exactly as efficiently as Euclidean, because homogeneous matrices, they're all the same thing. And so if you ever decide to spend the effort, you can look up how to make a non-Euclidean geometry real-time renderer that works exactly as efficiently as the ones that people commonly use. It turns out, though, that humans don't... I've never seen somebody say, you know what I want to do? I want to play a game in a 3D world that uses a geometry I don't understand. Right? And so there hasn't been a lot of market for this. All right. So these are things we can do with homogeneous coordinates. There's a lot of these things. And there's a lot of ways this can go weirdly wrong. And so often what we do in practice is we either spend a lot of time trying to move through symbolic algebra of what we want it to do, and then write that in our code and hope we copied it correctly. Or we look up where somebody else did that. Okay? So let's just, for example, I'm just going to arbitrarily say, what does the glue look at? Glue is the graphics library utilities. And I see there's this C specification of eyes XYZ, center XYZ, up XYZ. And then it says, hey, if you tell me where the eye is and what you're looking at and what direction you want to be up, then define F to be this and normalize things like this, and here's your proof matrix. This matrix will make it look like you're looking in that direction from that point. Use it. And great, so you find out what this is, and if you want, you could push through the math and you could derive this matrix, right? It's not interesting in any obvious way, except somebody else did the math for you, okay? And you notice they actually also don't have the I coordinate here. They say down after this. It's like you multiply by the rotation and then you translate. But you could just put the I in here. You can find other definitions of it elsewhere. You could also say, ooh, how about frustum? That sounds fun. And they have this rules about how you make a frustum matrix, right? So you can go on and look at all these different things. People have derived them. There's a set of them that tend to work pretty well. And I find looking up glue look at, I always remember its name. And then from there, I have links to all the rest. And so these can be used. All of them are doing some combination of this kind of work that we talked about, right? You figure out how you want to get there, you combine it, you cancel out terms that cancel out, and you figure out what the final result is. Or you derive it all using vector algebra, or you derive it all with symbolic algebra. There's lots of ways to get there, but you always end up at the same matrix at the end. And so somebody's done the work, they've told you what the matrix is, you move on with your life. So why did I spend all this effort talking about it if at the end I was just going to say look it up? Well, partly this is how it works. And that's sort of what we're trying to teach you, right? How it works. Partly you're going to have to do it, and you'll just look it up, and that'll be fine. But there is this understanding of how it works. There's also this understanding this can do things we haven't really talked about. Okay? This can do things like hyperbolic geometry and so on. There's power here we haven't really invested in. Because there's more degrees of freedom in a 4x4 matrix than we need. And so we have a little bit of extra freedom to do things we never do. And if you do some of them, weird things will happen. You're like, what happened? But this is the basic component. And almost all computer graphics uses homogeneous coordinates, uses these transformation matrices, sometimes restricts to affine, sometimes also lets you do perspective. Thoughts, comments, questions about homogeneous coordinates? Yes?
It's a weird question, but
Okay, so if I were, say, defining a building a graphics library, and I wanted to give the user one way to make a transformation, and like, would providing them the affine transformations be like it? That'd be enough.
I'm writing code to be used by artists or to be used by programmers. Then sure, say here's the matrix. They'll give you almost everything they expect to see.
So there's nothing they'd be missing out on?
There is, but they expect to miss out on it because everybody else misses out on it too. Let's just arbitrarily, let's pick one of the better developed ones of these. Let's look at the Java Graphics 2D API. Well, that's an old version of Java, but let's look at this. All right, so they say, okay, you can draw strokes and text and so on, and then it's got all of this stuff, and it says, you know, what can you do? You can draw different kinds of things and fill them in and stroke things. What do we have? We have rotate, we have scale, we have set transform with an affine transformation, and we have translate. Okay, and then go say, what's the affine transformation? It says, oh, it's this matrix I just told you about. Okay, but then it says, hey, we just don't bother storing that last thing. And they'll actually talk about it and so on. Yeah, this is what virtually they all do. This is what OpenGL gives you. This is what all of the other DirectX and so on. They all give you this because this is what our hardware does. This is what's available.
Why would it 3x3?
Because this is 2D. So there's only XY1, not XYZ1, for the one I happen to look up. Other questions? Yeah?
So you did a lot with like higher dimensions, and basically at the end of this you end up crossing out one of the dimensions anyways, you put on a 2D plane.
Yeah.
So is there any benefit considering that like zero-filled matrix are faster using all these matrix multiplies, and you're going to cross something out anyways, why not just cross out two things?
So you're saying if I'm using 4D geometry and I want to end up showing a 2D picture, is it more efficient to have zeros in the matrices along the way?
Yeah, just using more memory.
In principle, it could be, but in practice, it's usually not, because usually these matrices end up being dense. So if you're rotating, translating, and scaling, you end up with different numbers in every cell of your matrix. And so there's not an inefficiency in storing all of that information. Could you have done half of the transformation, then thrown away a coordinate, then done the other half? Yes, but that involved two matrix multiplies instead of one, which ends up costing you in computation. So for very high dimensional spaces, if you go into like some aspects of machine learning, we'll deal with 100 dimensional spaces, and they'll also be dealing with matrices, but there'll be zeros almost everywhere. And so they will deal with it in a very different way. And they won't talk about rotations and so on, although that's really what they're doing. If you try to think about it that way, you end up with highly dense matrices that are really inefficient to deal with. But as long as most cells in the final matrix are going to end up being meaningfully different, it's usually more efficient to just compose them and run with it. There's a whole lot more we could say about that, but it's probably out of the scope of graphics. So if you want to talk more, come to my office sometime. Other questions? Okay. 6 minutes. All right, yeah, we can do something useful in 6 minutes. Let's talk briefly about the idea of a frustum. Do any of you, have any of you encountered the word frustum outside of computer graphics? All right, frustum turns out to be a really old word. It means truncated pyramid. Okay, so a frustum is a square or rectangular base, a square or rectangular top. The top is smaller than the base. That's a frustum. We talk about them a lot more in computer graphics than anywhere else. Why? Yeah. It isn't because there's a lot of frustums we want to draw on computers. It's not an important enough shape. It just isn't. The importance of this shape actually has to do with rendering 3D. And that actually has, so when we are going to view some scene, we have, I don't know, some scene we want to draw. Okay, and we decide there's some camera out here. Oh, let's draw an old style dual camera, why don't we? All right, so we have some camera, and we want to simulate what does this camera see? We could try to look at the entire scene, but that is surprisingly inefficient. We think about what we are doing, we are dividing by W. So we're essentially taking some space and we're dividing by depth. But the depth right at the camera is zero, and dividing by zero is problematic. And dividing by things that are really close to zero is also problematic. It tends to make big things. So we're gonna just sort of, and then we're putting this on a rectangle, so we sort of are gonna say, okay, there's some square, and anything closer than that, we don't wanna draw. Okay, so we want to chop off the things and be dividing by close to zero numbers. Now, infinity, also bad. Okay, you actually do have infinities in your floating point operations in your computer, but they're much less efficient than finite numbers. And so somewhere out here, we want to say, you know, that's just big enough. That's far enough out, so we're going to bound our scene. And this bounded scene is a frustum. Okay, so we often will talk in computer graphics about what we will call the view frustum. The thing we do with the view frustum is make a homogeneous matrix that turns the view frustum into a cube. Almost always a cube, sometimes a different rectangular prism, but we're going to turn it into a cube. How do we turn it into a cube? Well, we divide by depth. That will scale the back end. That will make it parallel, and then we'll just squish it down until it's the right size. So you'll have some magical matrix that we will slide this through, and out the other side will come a neatly packaged cube. Okay? We want it to be a cube, not a square, because depth matters. We need to know what was farther away and what was closer to us so we know what to draw on top of what. We could make a matrix that turned it into a square, but then everything would all be on top of itself and we wouldn't know what to draw first. So we leave it as a cube. We're going to draw only one face of the cube, effectively. We're going to draw only one face of the cube by just ignoring one of the coordinates. Ignoring whatever coordinate was originally the growing one, because that's the one that's depth in our usual way of viewing. But we're going to keep the cube so we know what was close and what was far. And so this frustum matrix, the one that turns the frustum into a cube, is really important. And because we're going to turn it into a cube and then we're going to use various tricks to deal with things, it matters quite a bit where we pick as the near and far plane of the frustum. If they're too far apart, all of the interesting stuff will be squished into a tiny little sliver of the cube. If they're too close together, some interesting stuff will be cut off at the back or front end. Okay? And so we want to try to pick our clipping planes, our near and far clipping planes, an appropriate depth, so basically the cube is close to uniformly filled with interesting stuff, so that when we go to draw the cube, we end up with useful stuff. So our frustums are really important. What do we do with that last coordinate, right? So I have a cube, and it has an x coordinate, and it has a y coordinate, and I'm going to use those to draw something on the screen. But it also has, the way I drew this, a negative z coordinate. And I use that to mean depth. This is very nicely bounded between some fixed numbers because I made it into a cube. I know what the smallest one is. I know what the biggest one is. And so what we're going to do is instead of trying to draw everything in order, because that's just painful, we'll talk about ways we can try doing that in class on Thursday. But instead of trying to do that directly, what we'll often do is we'll just draw everything in any old order that happens to work for us. And if that means we draw the thing in the back first, and then the thing in the front, and then thing behind both of them, okay, that's fine. Each of these is going to turn into, as we scan convert it, into a bunch of little individual fragments. And each of these fragments, I know what z it had. So I'm going to end up, on a single pixel, I may end up with three different fragments. And each of those fragments has color and maybe other information, but it also has Z. And so I can just sort those and draw the one in front, or composite them with transparency, or whatever it is I want to do on an individual per fragment level. And because I know the bounds of this, there's various things I could do to make this more efficient in hardware, and we will talk more about that in class on Thursday. I will see you all on Thursday.